Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. Today I've got a one-on-one interview with Andy Alexander, an award-winning journalist and former ombudsman at The Washington Post. Andy has been an investigative journalist around the world, heading up foreign bureaus in London, Jerusalem, Beijing, and Moscow, just to name a few. He was chief of the Cox Newspaper's Washington Bureau when it shared in the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. Besides serving on numerous media-related boards, Andy helped launch the National Sunshine Week initiative promoting greater openness in government. I'm glad you're here, Andy. Welcome.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, before we do, you know, I read a little bit of your resume. What are you working on these days?
Well, my quick life in journalism. I spent 38 years with Cox Newspapers, which is part of the Cox Enterprises company, a fabulous company. And then I became the ombudsman for the Washington Post, which is a 2-year term. So you know when you take it, you're going to be out in 2 years unless you decide to extend. And after that, I started getting involved with my alma mater at Ohio University, which has the Scripps College of Communication, which is one of the largest in the country. And they got me involved mainly in media innovation. They had received a $3 million grant from the Scripps Howard Foundation to develop media innovation programs, and they needed someone to sort of lead that. And so I started doing that almost on a part-time basis, but I've gotten sucked deeper and deeper into it. Because it's so darn interesting. I mean, we were at that time in journalism. So I spend a lot. I'm based in Washington. I go to Ohio University every few weeks. I teach one class in media ethics, but my focus really is on media innovation.
So how would you define media innovation? What does that cover?
Well, it covers a lot because of what's going on in journalism. Maybe the best way to explain it is sort of the benchmark program we came up with that is helping orient students toward media innovation. Most colleges of communications have some form of a media innovation competition, and the vast majority of them simply say to students, come up with a fascinating, groundbreaking, interesting media innovation idea. It might be an app for something or a new way of using GPS to track things or whatever. Our starting point was different. We went out to media companies, mainly in Ohio and in the region, and we said, what are your specific media innovation needs? And then the students competed for that. So media innovation needs, or we call this competition the Scripps Innovation Challenge. So they're challenges. It might be as simple as the Columbus Dispatch had 60,000 Twitter followers, and they said, we don't know how to monetize this. or it was television stations that were saying, look, we look at millennials, which is basically students, and we see that they do not watch appointment TV, so-called appointment TV. They don't like ads. Many of them don't even own a television set. And so we are going to create apps to try to connect with them, but we don't even know how to do that. We don't know what will appeal to them. We don't even know how to reach them. So they turned to our students and said, can you help us?
Yeah, we're content creators. Help us try to get that content to an audience that's going to help sustain us.
That's exactly it. So these are the types of things. And so we had a competition that was opened to not just journalism students, it's open to anyone in the university. That's in recognition.
Business students, technical students would be helpful.
Engineering students. Media innovation may come from any place these days. And then we offered substantial cash prizes. We gave out 20,000 in prizes. So this came to a climax on April 11th, where we had a series of finalists who actually did a live pitch competition before industry judges. And we gave a 10,000 first prize and a lot of other money, and we're going to grow it next year.
So what was the top prize?
The top prize was a really interesting app idea, which the students called an alarm clock app. And it was in response to a challenge by a media company, Ogden Newspapers, that owns a lot of smaller community newspapers. And they were trying to find ways to engage people with their online products. So the students came up with this way that your iPhone would actually serve as an alarm clock, which of course is not new. But what you got instantly was an aggregated, highly tailored news report for you. So you woke up and you knew exactly the ball scores you wanted. You knew this and that. And then they had mechanisms for updating throughout the day and sending alerts.
Now, I know you're a little older than I am. When I was in journalism school at Indiana University in the early 1980s, and there was this thought, you know, that, oh, well, one day there will be these computers. We'll be getting our news on computers, and we'll have a thing where we'll be able to print off our newspaper every morning, and that's how we're going to get it. And on one sense, it's like, yeah, we're kind of there, but on the other, we're really kind of dealing with the reality of how we consume news now.
Yeah,
the fact that, you know, what you said about your students that aren't, they're not getting appointment TV, they're relying on their mobile platforms, their phones to get a lot of the content that they're going to want to get. We've had several different people in here who are connected with journalism education, and you know, all of them are very optimistic, very excited, and very interested in what the students are bringing to the discussion. So, what's your takeaway from the students that you see?
The first takeaway is I'm envious of them. I think this is a fabulous time to be getting into journalism because so much is happening.
Mm-hmm.
There is a tremendous disconnect between when I talk to my older friends in my age cohort. I'm in my 60s
sure.
now, people who I worked with at Cox or with the Washington Post, and by and large, they are very depressed about the future of journalism.
Right.
Then I go to Ohio University, and these kids are so jazzed, correctly enthusiastic about the future of journalism. They see 6 or 7 different ways to tell a story. They mm-hmm. understand the concepts or the importance of data visualization, digital storytelling. They understand the way that gaming could be used to tell a complex
right.
story like the federal budget. What I worry about is that they get the proper grounding in the basics of journalism,
mm-hmm.
The ethical grounding, the basic concepts of the importance of getting it right first. One of the things I found, frankly, at the Washington Post when I went there was you had a divide of younger, digitally oriented mm-hmm. online folks who they were upset when they made errors online, but they were not mortified in the way
right.
that I was.
Right.
And they had a term, which is quite common. It's called not wrong for long, which
right.
means we can correct it quickly. We don't have to wait
right.
for the next day's paper. But, of course, my mindset is get it right the first time
right.
because news travels so quickly in the digital age. It's cached so quickly. It spreads so quickly that it's a real challenge to catch up with an error.
Right.
So that's what I'm talking about, giving them those fundamentals.
Yeah, it's getting a little too caught up in the bells and whistles and not mm-hmm. necessarily thinking of really the groundwork of again, conversations we've had with other people in my own experience is that you'll get people who, you know, can see the possibilities of various technical aspects of journalism and, oh, we'll be able to deliver the news quicker through Twitter alerts or through online platforms. We'll be able to do all different types of things, but they're not always thinking of the lessons that came out of print journalism,
right.
the lessons of sourcing and all of the ethical steps that we have to make sure we take so that, you know, to qualify us as journalists and not just somebody who's posting something online.
That's all true, and there's something else that I think younger journalists need to focus on, and that is the who pays for journalism part
right.
of it. This is something when I started out, let's face it, newspapers were making so damn much money,
right.
we never thought about it. In my first 20 years in journalism, I don't think I ever once thought about the
right.
business side. Now we have to. Now, that doesn't mean you have to subvert your values as a
no.
journalist, but one of the things when I deal with students is with this Scripps Innovation Challenge competition, we required them to have a business element to their presentation. That did not mean a full ROI or return
sure.
on investment. It didn't mean a full business plan. But it meant that they address, at a minimum, the fact that if you have a newsroom of 20 reporters and you're going to take one of them to develop an innovative idea, simply taking that staff time is a cost.
Mm-hmm.
Or ideally, we want to know what is the potential revenue stream. In the world today, I don't think we have a journalism problem. We have more journalism, good and bad, than
right.
we've ever had.
Right.
We have a revenue model problem.
Yeah.
And we have to be thinking that way of who pays for it. Doesn't mean we have to end up like Bill Gates or
right.
Steve Jobs, but it does mean that we have to have enough money to pay for our journalism.
Are we putting enough emphasis on the business side of journalism?
Clearly not. Clearly not. And we found this in our Scripps Innovation Challenge, that students, I would put this in the category of they don't know what they don't know
mm-hmm.
about the business side of journalism. And there's a cost. And I have at Ohio University at the Scripps College occasionally brought in people who are recent grads who started their own little media startup company.
Right.
Maybe they had an innovative idea. And it's surprising when you ask them, maybe they're 1 year out from graduation, what do you know now that you didn't know? And typically it goes this way. Well, I hired somebody. I didn't realize I had to take out withholding taxes. Mm-hmm. You know, I decided to patent this. I didn't realize I needed a lawyer. I didn't realize that I needed insurance. I didn't realize that I needed to hire a lawyer for this, or, you know, I needed to do that. There was a real cost associated with marketing and all those things. They simply don't know what they don't know. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to instill that. It's interesting to me talking to I talk to a lot of media companies now. Mm-hmm. Oddly, in my career, I am now almost more engaged with a broad spectrum of media companies than I was during my career working for one very right. large one or whatever.
Well, your focus was on gathering news.
It was, I was running newsrooms.
You're not thinking about trying how to save the industry.
No, or as an ombudsman, I was dealing with what was going on in the newsroom. But talking to news organizations and media companies that are hiring, they not only want young people that have the basics, the journalistic grounding, they want people who think innovatively and think entrepreneurially. Mm-hmm. And again, they're not asking them to develop something and then make it work in a financial sense, but they want them attuned to that so that then they can bring it to their business people, their marketing people, and say, right. okay, we think it has potential. Now you develop it, and we'll get back to the business of journalism.
Yeah, I think there's been, for a long time, there was a lot of people just easily gravitating towards the, you know, the news delivery end of it and not really sort of thinking about how this new digital technology could actually, you know, make money for a company.
You're absolutely right.
There wouldn't be, you know, that wasn't part of the consideration. I know my own personal story. I was at a .com that went the way of many websites in 2000. And I went back to print going, well, you know, I'll come back to online in a few years once the business model's been all figured out. And I came back to the online world, and it hasn't been figured out yet. I was a little surprised.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of big minds have been working on it. And I think, I agree with you very much that we need to, you know, instill in you know, the people who are coming into the industry, especially the people who are coming out of journalism schools, that, you know, to understand the entrepreneurial and the business side of it. Because they're gonna, you know, if they want a future in journalism, they're mm-hmm. gonna have to be part of coming up with a solution to what's going on in journalism. Do you feel that, you know, do we need to bring in some other type of education? I mean, does there need to be in business schools? There need to be some sort of entrepreneurial media classes or something that could somehow be crossed over so that you're coming at it from that angle as opposed mm-hmm. to, here, we're journalists, this is your semester of business, or this is your semester of entrepreneurial.
Mm-hmm. We do in several respects. And I think in the more progressive schools, and I would count Scripps among them, they are thinking that way. They are altering curricula. They are thinking of certificate programs. But then, more to your original point, I think what you're seeing is a very healthy and robust debate among colleges of communications and journalism schools on the value of, I guess, people like me. I'm not saying me, but
right.
people like me that have spent their life in industry and are coming right in, and they are not as theory-based, but they are able to bring a connection to what's happening in industry right now mm-hmm. and force students to even be aware of what's out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, almost any of my dealings in a classroom with students, which are limited, I just teach this one course, but, you know, I'm basically pushing them constantly to be on the industry websites and discuss the things that are in the news, not just the ethical dilemmas,
mm-hmm.
but what's happening on the business side. What are mm-hmm. we learning about paywalls?
Right.
What are we learning about the decline of print advertising or the resurgence in some areas? I mean,
mm-hmm.
we tend to forget that newspapers are still a $36 billion industry.
Right.
That's nothing to sniff at.
Oh, no. There's still money being made in print. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I don't think necessarily the print's going to go away. I think, you know, a lot of people sort of like threw their hands up when a number of big papers folded and they thought, oh, my God, this is the end. Well, mm-hmm. this is the transition, and we're still in the transition, I think.
It's not a good trend.
But,
but I think that we'll have a mix. I think what we may end up with, I mean, here we are in Washington. If you look at the Washington Post,
yeah, right.
its circulation has continued to decline. Print advertising is declining. They have significant challenges. It may be 5 years from now that we pay for home delivery a lot more.
Right.
Or to get it delivered to your office a lot more. Or it may be a tailored publication in different ways. But right. I think we're starting to find our way.
For example, I know there are a lot of people always talk about, the Sunday Times. I love getting the Sunday Times. I'm like, well, maybe that's an experience that you're going to have to pay a little extra for if they're still going to print it or you're just going to get it on your iPad.
You're raising a very good point because you do pay a lot more for the Sunday Times. And one of the trends at the Times particularly is that their circulation revenue is demonstrably higher as a percentage of total revenues than it was even 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. We just can't make it on advertising alone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, when I give talks about this, it's interesting. I get people in my age cohort who just say, I can't imagine life without the printed newspaper, and I don't understand why young people don't get this.
Because that's not where they're at.
Well, I tell them to envision a teenager, let's say Johnny is 14, who has never seen a newspaper in the mm-hmm. household. All he's done is he's gotten his information online or through mobile.
Right.
And try to explain to little Johnny that we're going to have a newspaper coming in. And you would have to explain these big sheets of paper that doesn't have any video, may not even have all color pictures.
Mm-hmm.
The news will be sometimes 8 or 9 years old or hours old. You know, the way we're going to print it is we're going to cut down forests and mash up the trees. And we have these things called presses that cost about $150 million. And then what we'll do is we'll hire these people to come around before dawn and throw it on your lawn. And if it rains, we'll put a bag over it.
Mm-hmm.
It's inconceivable.
No.
I mean, it is so stupid when you think of it in a digital
context. It was the way we could deliver the news in an effective, efficient way, 100 years ago.
Yep.
And things changed.
It worked then.
And the technology has certainly made the whole environment very different mm-hmm. for media. And just to sort of touch on something you were talking about before, about the fact that, sort of edge out of the business end of it, but just talk a little bit about the news production end of it.
Mm-hmm.
You said that that what we have is a pretty big smorgasbord, or my word, mm-hmm. that we have a lot of things that we didn't have. The quality of news, I think, has improved.
In some cases.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe the quality isn't the word I want to use. Certainly the mass of a news.
The availability of news.
And the delivery system and the speed of it. But again, we go back to things like, the ethics and accuracy of what we're producing.
Mm-hmm.
And that forever remains a challenge. Let me talk to you a little bit about your time at the Washington Post mm-hmm. as the ombudsman. What did you see as your role there as the ombudsman?
I was the reader's representative.
Mm-hmm.
What was beautiful about what the Post had and what the Times, New York Times, still has is a truly independent ombudsman who represented just basically readers, not the newsroom. It's an extraordinary construction of the job in the sense that my wife's a lawyer, and when I was hired, they gave me a one-page contract that it was not clear that I even had a boss. In fact, I was mm-hmm. there 2 years. I don't know who I reported to. My column...
as long as the check showed up.
My column went through the editorial page, mm-hmm. but only because that's where it appeared. But I had no one who reviewed me. To the great credit of the Washington Post, tried to talk me out of a column. There were people who worked the refs.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, your job is to try to hold the newsroom to its own high standards and to represent the interests of readers who, let's be honest, sometimes they would complain about stories to reporters and the reporters either wouldn't take their phone call, wouldn't answer their emails, or simply blew them off,
mm-hmm.
tried to talk them out of corrections or whatever. And that's when the ombudsman gets involved, when a reader has said satisfaction, they won't correct this error. And I think what's been lost by the elimination that is that the readers do not have an independent voice. Now, to mm-hmm. give you some idea of the volume of what we deal with as mm-hmm. ombudsman, and I'm pretty sure my successor, Pat Pexton, was in the same category because we've talked about this. During my 2 years there, I received just north of 141,000 emails.
Wow.
Now, 3/4 of those are from crazy people or homophobes or racists, and I didn't even respond mm-hmm. to them. But when I handed off to Patrick, I did a little study, and I had offered a meaningful response to more than 40,000 of them. Meaningful response might be simply an explanation of something that how the paper functioned, for instance. Mm-hmm. Why is there this fact in this editorial and this fact in the story about this issue in the Metro section? Don't they talk to each other? Well, no, they don't. No. They're completely separate. So, but a more meaningful and common thing is somebody says, they made a mistake. They won't respond to me. That requires the ombudsman to go to the newsroom, to sit on someone's desk and say, hey, Helen, this person says you screw up. What do you say? Mm-hmm. And what can come of that is either I can render a judgment in an email back to the reader, or I might blog about it, or worst case, or best case, I would write a column about it. Mm-hmm. But the point of all this is that when people look at the ombudsman's job, they see this Sunday column and they think, well, that's pretty cushy job. Just you are moving at an unbelievable pace when mm-hmm. you're dealing with that many things. And it also speaks to the need. Mm-hmm. There are that many people that feel they need a voice.
So you wouldn't say that in an environment where you have a place where people can make comments or people can tweet or, you know, just send emails to directly to the reporter, that the reporter tweets out and retweets things, that there isn't enough dialogue?
No, I applaud that. I think that's a wonderful trend. I believe in online commenting, and I even believe in anonymous mm-hmm. online commenting. But nothing takes the place of an independent ombudsman who can go into the newsroom and demand answers. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get those answers, it can appear in print for every reader of the Washington Post to read. And the ombudsman carries weight. You know, I think in the industry, mm-hmm. you don't want to be zinged by the ombudsman. It's just not a good thing.
So what happens then as, you know, certainly newspapers are cutting staffs, mm-hmm. Newspapers are going under. They're trying to become leaner, smarter about the way they use their resources. What then is the future of the ombudsman? Mm-hmm. Is it something that's going to go away? Is it going to reemerge in a different form?
I think the jury's out. Clearly, the trends among American newspapers mm-hmm. Is that they are being phased out in part for money reasons. I mean, mm-hmm. the Washington Post, I thought, had a poor explanation of why they eliminated it. They said money was a factor. I don't doubt that. Mm-hmm. But they also said that we think there are more avenues. But as I've just said, I think there's nothing replaces the independent mm-hmm. inquiry. But I think what you may see is that there are different configurations for ombudsman. So let's just talk generically about news organizations. Maybe what you have is you can come up with a formulation where you have maybe retired journalists who have a specialization in an area, mm-hmm. let's say the Middle East or foreign policy, and they get the complaints routed to them, and they have this authority for very little money, and I bet you there'd be a lot of people who do this for free, mm-hmm. that they would investigate those complaints and render judgments. We may be able to play around with that. Clearly, the trend is to do it more digitally. Now, I was blogging several times a week, which is not sufficient. Mm-hmm. But as I say, 141,000 emails, you have very little time to push out a reported blog every day. But I think that's where we're headed. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should be wedded necessarily to the Sunday column in the print
right.
paper. I think we should be writing as things come up and as quickly as possible.
Right. Again, because the sooner that you can, especially in an online environment, the sooner you can correct something, the sooner mm-hmm. it's not going to be retweeted and shared a million different places.
But you just, to follow up on your point here, the role of the ombudsman is growing in certain parts of the world, though. Mm-hmm. It's because people see it as a means of building your credibility. Mm-hmm. I believe the Post has lost some standing with readers. Mm-hmm. Is it going to put the Post out of business because they don't have an ombudsman? Of course not.
No.
But I think it's one of those small things that's lost that readers feel, I don't have a voice anymore.
I see the Post is a big bear in a cave trying to turn around, that little pieces fall off here and there, and whenever it ends, wherever it's going to stop, you know, it's going to be probably very different than what we had always thought of it as. And again, you know, the value of these pieces that fall off, the things that, you know, when they cut staff, when they say, well, we need to reprioritize this way. And I don't want to jump all over the Post. I mean, a lot of newspapers are having to deal with this issue. I mean, if you cut and you cut and you cut, when do you not become what you were of value for?
Well, and you're absolutely right. And then the question is, a value to whom? Because right. what I think the added burden, and let me just say, I it was an honor for me to work for the Post, right. and I think it's a fabulous newspaper. But right. they have a challenge that many others don't face. In print, which still supplies most of their revenue,
right.
they have to be a great paper.
Right.
And they have, in my opinion, I wrote this, I think they need to do a better job with local coverage. But they're trying to do that while developing digitally.
Right.
And the challenge is that the digital audience is almost all outside of Washington.
Right.
So they don't care about local. So if, in a management sense, you're asking a staff to do much more
yeah.
with fewer resources and say, make a great local paper in print and online. And by the way, your future is with this audience that's outside Washington, do even a better job there. That's a very, very difficult
thing. Yeah, we had Tom Jackman in a couple of months ago, and he talked about this very problem you speak of, the fact that it's almost like two companies. Mm-hmm. It's the Washington Post that covers the city of Washington, and the Washington Post that everybody recognizes internationally as a leading mm-hmm. newspaper, and the people are coming at it from two different areas. Can they sustain in that form? Well, let's wait and see. I mean, it certainly has been an interesting ongoing drama for the last 10 or 15 years to watch them sort of morph. And
it's very tough. I think they're developing a strategy which I actually applaud. Digitally, they've sort of adopted the Google fail fast approach. They are trying a lot of things mm-hmm. and hoping that enough of them hit that they will collectively produce revenue to offset these very substantial print revenue losses.
Mm-hmm.
So far, it is insufficient. I'm not
right.
saying the effort is wrong. I applaud the effort.
No.
But it's a big challenge.
No, I think any media outlet has to find some success in the mm-hmm. digital realm if it's going to survive, you know, in the next 10, 20 years. That's where everything's going, unless there's something that's coming down the pike, like the internet was, you know, 10, 15 years ago that we're not aware of, that's suddenly going to change everything again.
And, you know, some consolation for, we've talked about newspapers, but,
yeah.
you know, let's not forget what's happening to broadcast and specifically
oh, yeah.
television. I mean, it was interesting to me being in Ohio working on this innovation challenge because I was mm-hmm. talking to a lot of GMs of TV stations, and this is in the period right after the election.
Right.
And, of course, Ohio was a battleground state. And I would say, how's your year gone? And they would say, fabulous. We had the best year ever in advertising. We couldn't fit more advertising on. So I'd say, you're pretty optimistic about the future, right? And they say, no, we're absolutely terrified because we see it as a cliff.
Right.
And we don't know how to reach those new people. I mean, I think we're not far from millennials or younger people and a lot of older people getting their TV through an app.
Right.
You know, and how do you monetize it?
Right. If there's a TV show that you like on HBO, do I need to pay that enormous cable bill,
absolutely.
Or do I wait for it to come out on Netflix or just digitally download it off of iTunes?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this capitalist system, but you know, you know, it drives so much that it, you know, people's pocketbook makes quite a lot of decisions mm-hmm. that when they get down to it, they said, well, this is cheaper, this is better for me, and mm-hmm. I'll adjust to that.
But let's go back to the starting point.
Oh, yeah.
Would you not like to be a young person who's jazzed
oh, no.
about journalism? I mean, I think it's a fabulous time
oh, no.
to be part of figuring this out.
I had this. Yeah, I mean, I've told this on the podcast before, but I'm going to tell it away because it's one of my favorite stories. When I was a managing editor and I was really – this is when I was taking classes at American University, and I was really full of, you know, vim and vigor about the possibilities that digital journalism presented and the future and everything. And we got a new batch of interns in, and they were high school interns, so they were probably a little too young for me to make the speech. But I looked at them very emphatically and said, I am envious of you. You came in at a perfect time in journalism. Everything's changing. And they had this look of horror on their face. They were like, what do you mean it's all changing? Because they want to write the story. They want it on
sure.
the front page. They want to see their picture next to their byline. And but it is. And one of the reasons I'm still in journalism, one of the reasons I'm doing this stupid podcast is because I'm really kind of excited about what's going on, that there's so much possibilities just in news, you know, in news reporting and doing it in different platforms. These are problems that we're faced with. Now, that gives us an opportunity to try and solve them. That's exciting stuff.
It does. And, you know, One thing that I think we need to place more emphasis on, and here we are in Washington. I'm a Washington journalist. You've spent your career here. But if I had it to do over again, I would be very intrigued by going to a place like Des Moines or Keokuk and trying to serve in a community. And this goes back to the basics of journalism. We've talked about fairness, accuracy, mm-hmm. ethics. But I think another thing I try to instill in journalism, young journalists, is less where you do journalism right. or for whom, as opposed to why you do it.
Yeah.
And I am continually impressed. I'll give you an example. Last weekend, I was with a friend of mine, Marty Kaiser, who is the editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's an unbelievably gifted editor. This is a regional, you know, a metro paper that has won 3 Pulitzer Prizes for news, mm-hmm. more than the Washington Post has won since 2008. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably accurate. But he produces a high-quality product that is not in Washington. You know, it's not in right. Los Angeles. It serves a big community, but it really has captured its community. He knows what is important to those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even if you did that in a small place like Warrenton, Virginia or whatever, mm-hmm. I think there's tremendous value in that and enormous satisfaction in serving a community that way.
Oh, no. I was at the Connection newspapers for 10 years, and one of the reasons was because people really valued the stuff that you were doing. You know, some of it, you did the Girl Scout bake sale sometimes, but then you also did some really important stories about, you know, the environment, about local government and schools and things that just, you know, had a lot of value. And one of the great things about where we were in the strata of journalism, we got a lot of people straight out of journalism school, caught them early on. You know, obviously they had dreams of going elsewhere and they mm-hmm. did go elsewhere, but they saw the value of, you know, covering, you know, being the reporter on the ground. We used to joke all the time that the local TV stations or the Washington Post would pick up a story that we had written about 2 or 3 weeks later because they had seen that we'd done the initial reporting on it. And then they would cover it big and it would be a big thing. It was on TV and everybody was really happy about it. But, you know, there is something nice, a certain amount of pride going out and finding a story and, you know, talking to the people that it affects one-on-one and seeing something positive come out of it.
That's the key,
When you're able to have that human element and make change mm-hmm. With just the work that you do, with the words that you write, the story that you tell, I mean, that's really, I think, the value of journalism at its core. I mean, we get kind of caught up in all of the bells and the whistles, you know, I got to go to Washington to cover the Congress or the White House. But really, I mean, to tell the story of the human heart and the human experience and elicit change in the world, I mean, that's a real valuable thing for what we do.
I agree.
We don't always talk about it.
I agree 100%. And also, you know this, starting outside of Washington, you acquire skills that if you are going to make it in Washington and make it big, you'll need those skills. When I was a bureau chief in Washington for Cox Newspapers, we had a very good internship program, and a number of those interns would jump right out of college to mm-hmm. Washington. They all got jobs. They were very bright. It was a selective internship. But in most cases, they only went so high.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons was they didn't learn about mill rates, or they didn't ride with the cops to know how wickedly clever they can be as interviewers and getting information.
Right.
And those are all things that really serve you well when you start.
Standing outside in the rain, outside a church or something.
Exactly.
You know, just waiting for somebody to talk to.
Or dealing with these very difficult emotional issues.
I mean,
somebody's kid is killed in a shooting, and you have to go talk to the family. And
right.
How do you do that? But it's important. Those are very important things.
No. Okay. Yeah. I cannot disagree. Mm-hmm. So before we wrap up, I did want to talk to you a little bit about your involvement in the sort of open government initiative mm-hmm. that you were one of the founders of the Sunshine Week initiative. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that came about and what's your sort of, you know, interest in the whole open government transparency.
Well, it really started for me long before I got involved in organizationally in that, because with Cox Newspapers and our bureau, we were doing a lot of good project journalism that required on open records, and we were doing a lot of database stuff. And so I had that sort of practical orientation of the importance of it. But then it was through the American Society of News Editors that I started to get involved, and I became the chair of their FOI committee. And this would be, maybe about 2002, 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And we became very, very concerned about trends at the federal level.
2000, 2003. I wonder what was going on then.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, there was a clampdown, and it probably even started – well, actually, it started my involvement before that. But after 9/11, mm-hmm. there was this visceral, we got to shut down everything.
Close all the doors.
And the Bush administration was pretty tough on this. I think clearly not the worst in history. There have been a lot mm-hmm. worse times, a lot worse administrations. But there were bad trend lines. And the effect of that was that it was going down to the state and local levels. So we gathered people together. The Knight Foundation funded a summit of people who were involved in freedom of information. It was held at the old museum or Freedom Forum.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, people focused on something that had happened in Florida. They had had something called Sunshine Sunday.
Right.
They started it because Florida, which is a great open record state, has admirable.
You can get
history.
All your police records with photos Fabulous. And everything online.
But they noticed that lawmakers were really trying to enact a whole bunch of exemptions. Mm-hmm. So they picked a Sunday in March that coincided with the opening of the legislative session.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked newspapers, television stations to, on that Sunday, try to bring importance and visibility to this issue. So mm-hmm. at a minimum, newspapers wrote editorials. There were some newspapers that were very clever. Every story in that day's paper that relied on an open records law, mm-hmm. they would highlight that just to tell readers you wouldn't have gotten this information without mm-hmm. it. Some did audits of agencies and all that. So we looked at the success of that, and it was very successful in raising public awareness of the importance of it. And we thought, well, could we do this on a national level, and could we have a week? So we started it in 2005 with a grant from the Knight Foundation, very generous. And we essentially tried to replicate what they had done in Florida. And we thought that first year, well, gosh, maybe if we get 50 or 60 papers to do something, that'd be great. It was hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
And it has grown over the years to involve all types of media companies, civic organization, rotary clubs, libraries, mm-hmm. Different associations. And the whole point is not to make it a press week.
Right.
It's really about public discussion of the importance of transparency in government, which we all know leads to more efficient government, less corrupt government. The number of stories produced every year relying on open records that find people who are double-dipping on,
right.
on public payrolls or the looking at bids on public contracts and realizing it went to the highest bidder because he had a connection rather than the lowest connection.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we see stories all the time. If you can look into the driving records of school bus drivers and you find out, my gosh,
right.
somebody's driving a school bus and they've had 16 moving violations or whatever. Those are the types of stories that bring public awareness and pressure and just make communities better.
It's funny. I sort of connected two things, what you're talking about, the having newspapers sort of talk about where they're where the records, the public records are that informed a particular story. I mean, it sort of goes back to what you're talking about before about the role of the ombudsman mm-hmm. is the fact that, and this is my experience as being an editor, that there are a lot of people that don't understand what a newspaper is or how a newspaper functions. And I think maybe that has a lot to do with our bad PR with a lot of people, is that they think that we're doing all these machinations. We've got these secret things. Man, if we had the time to do these secret things, it would be great, but we don't. Transparency in the way in our process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talk about open government a lot in press because it's, you know, that's where our bread and butter is. We're reporting this stuff, but you know, this is everybody. You know, FOIA is for everybody. It's mm-hmm. it's not just a press thing. You know, the public needs to be able to get this information,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of our role in it. So, how can we better? You know, what can we do beyond the Sunshine Week to get the news out to get people more aware of openness?
Well, a couple things, and it sort of it melds one of the thoughts you had there. The first thing is, I think news organizations generally should not focus on it 1 year or 1 week out of the year. It's this is an ongoing
issue. It's like the people go to church on Christmas
yeah.
only.
And the second thing I think we can do is explain why we want sensitive information. Mm-hmm. This is sort of in the news now with the, right. the AP subpoenas and all that. But there's an opportunity for media organizations to explain how we handle sensitive stories. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things, I wrote a column about this as ombudsman. I wrote a column at the Post about the perception that you'll print anything in the Post.
And the we point, don't want to get sued. We
and
don't
the point of the column was to detail as best I could all the things the Post does not print. Mm-hmm. And I went to editors who had handled these highly sensitive national security stories. Mm-hmm. And they told me on background in many cases, because these were conversations that in one case had gone on in the Oval Office. But it is amazing how sensitive the media are to important stories like that, mm-hmm. and how much we are willing, as we should, to step back from publishing certain information that might enhance the story but is not critical to it but could cause
right, harm.
So, you know, things like you certainly don't want to finger a CIA agent.
Right.
But you do want to write about abuses, and there are ways to do that. So there's, I think, to your point about transparency in news organization, it builds credibility mm-hmm. to explain generally how we do our jobs, but specifically in relation to freedom of information. Mm-hmm. We could do a much better job of saying, why do we need this information?
Right.
And frankly, there are some times I don't think we need it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been intrigued by the debates over people, news organizations that get...
like the gun records?
The gun things, the concealed weapon registries, and then publish them. Well, yeah, we have a legal right to it. And in some cases, let's be honest, it's a public document. Anybody could go online. Mm-hmm. But the question is why?
Right.
Did we provide proper context? Did we go through the list and find out that there are certain people that maybe have a criminal record that had gotten through? Now, that's a good story.
Right.
But simply taking the information just because we have it and printing it, not always the smartest way.
It becomes more of a stunt and less of an actual
act
of journalism.
And there you lose credibility.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. That's mm-hmm. that's for sure. Did you you mentioned in the news and everything about the AP. This is a few days after that story sort of broke. You know, what's your takeaway at this point? How concerned are you about
very concerned
about the Justice Department's
very concerned
actions?
And you know, I was troubled by Attorney General Holder's comments yesterday. Now that we're taping this at a time when the story just broke yesterday,
right,
and
right.
he had initial comments today. I haven't kept up with his testimony before the House, but you know, his initial comment was that he had recused himself, that the decision had been made by the Deputy Attorney General. But let me tell you, it was a serious breach and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we've heard that before, mm-hmm. and it's what typically plays out here is that when you get into how they reached the decision to go after a reporter,
mm-hmm.
they didn't truly exhaust all other avenues mm-hmm. as the guidelines require. They did not, in this case, as the guidelines require, allow going to the news organization and saying, we have a concern, let's negotiate here.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a rush to judgment, a rush decision, and it's hard for people not in the news business to understand the chilling effect that has on mm-hmm. people. Not everybody does national security reporting, let's grant
right.
that. But the way it filters down, when people think that your government is basically monitoring the activities of journalists,
mm-hmm.
It has a chilling effect on everyone who might be willing to talk to those journalists about legitimate abuses of government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very damaging.
Yeah. No.
If anything good comes out of it, it will revive discussion about a federal shield law, which I think has already started.
Well, that's good. These things always they appear, and you know, it's good that we get stories like this. Unfortunately, this event had to happen, but it brings back, you know, it brings these issues back into the public debate, so people sort of again understand what our roles are as journalists and why we do things the way we do them, and why certain freedoms that we really embrace are so important to the work that we do and to the public, because this is. You know, we're trying to provide information to the public about whatever, a corrupt official or some other story that could have a serious impact. And so,
it also gets into the I hate to be cynical about this, but who is doing the leaking? I mean, I've been amazed over the years about Republican administrations or Democratic administrations that just get so exercised when a leak has come from the administration. But we know when they have something to leak, they leak it.
Oh, yeah.
No, and these are the same people that complain when it's a leak that damages them.
No, it all depends on who has the ball.
Yeah.
And that's how things work out. Well, this has been really entertaining, Andy. How can people find out about you? Are you blogging currently?
I'm not blogging currently, but I'm not hard to find.
Okay.
I mean, I'm at Ohio University. You can find me on their website there, or you can find me through Facebook or whatever.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming in. This has been a great discussion.
Great. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @alljournalism.